Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Anthony Brooks in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The news for the newspaper industry just gets worse. As circulation numbers continue to slide, once mighty dailies are cutting more staff and closing bureaus. And yet, as newsrooms thin out and print pages dwindle, blogs are booming. One of the blogging's brightest lights, Andrew Sullivan of The Atlantic, makes some bold claims for blogs in a new essay, Why I Blog. He says they herald a golden era of journalism. Is he right? This hour on Point, can serious journalism be saved by bloggers? You can join the conversation. Where do you get your news? Do you read blogs? Do you write them? Is this the end of the morning paper on your stoop? And if so, are you worried that our society loses something important if we lose old-fashioned journalism? And joining me now from Washington is Andrew Sullivan. He's a senior editor at The Atlantic, where he writes the blog The Daily Dish. His most recent article, Why I Blog, appears in The Atlantic's November issues. He's a former editor of The New Republic and author of The Conservative Soul, How We Lost It, How to Get It Back. And Andrew Sullivan, welcome to the show. It's great to have you.
Thank you, Anthony. Lovely to be here.
Well, let's start. Let's just dive right in. You have a background as a writer and editor for The New Republic, The Wall Street Journal, The Washington Post, The Daily Telegraph, among others. What drew you to the world of blogging? Why did you want to make that move?
Well, it was 8 years ago, believe it or not. It was 2000. And basically, it was an amazing, simple fact. You could, from your own bedroom, reach as many people as one used to be able to reach by a regular, normal magazine. I was reaching as many readers within a couple of years as I did every week editing The New Republic. Only unlike editing a weekly magazine, I had no editor, no publisher, no colleagues to deal with, no difficulty in spending money on paper and print, none of the economic constraints. So it was a complete liberation to write opinion journalism and news journalism without any of these existing restraints. And it was a liberating experience. And 8 years ago, it felt even more liberating than it does now. But of course, we didn't have the audience then that we now have.
Here's what I took, one of the things I took away from your piece, Why I Blog, and I want to sort of, it's a bit of a challenge, so let me just throw it out there. I mean, I understand why blogging feels exciting and liberating to you as an experienced journalist. You know, you write about what you just mentioned, the idea that there's no filters, there's no editors, you can get the stuff out there quickly in real time. So I get why you like it, but what does it do for the product? I mean, how does it help sort of the consumer out there who's trying to figure out what's going on?
Well, I think, frankly, in this day and age, the institutional nature of journalism, in which people take on trust something that's provided by an institution like the New York Times or the Washington Post or even NPR, has somewhat eroded. People understand that they're just human beings behind these institutions. They are trained people, but they are just people. And an individual that just doesn't make any pretense and puts his own position or her own position out there and his or her own biases out there and then allows you to make your own mind up, both with the links that I might add or the opinions I might have, and respond back in real time, I think it's a more intimate, human, and therefore, in this day and age, trustworthy way of doing journalism than some of the more institutional and authoritative institutions of the past. That doesn't mean to say, and I really want to make this very strongly, this point, that that blogs can or should ever displace real reporting, journalism, the kind of difficult, long-form work that reporting and journalism absolutely needs to do. We are just a way to engage it, to think about it, to bring it to the surface, to bring all sorts of reports and journalism. And what I do every day is provide links to pieces of journalism that you would never get in just your single daily paper, from all over the world, from all different kinds of sources. In other words, I think it's also value added to the basic news.
Well, give us a sense of, actually, I've got a laptop open right in front of me. If you go to andrewsullivan.com, we'd get right to The Dish. What's a viewer, a news consumer going to find there?
Well, they're going to find all sorts of things. They're going to find my own opinions. They're going to find links to other people's opinions. They're going to find new information. They're going to find links to newspapers and journals across the world. They're going to listen to the views and emails from ordinary people also across the world. Each day I have a picture of a view from your window. One person across the world reading the blog actually will take a photograph of what they see outside the window. You'll get a sense of what it's like to be in these different places all over the world. So I think it's a blend of opinion, journalism, reporting, linkage that says, look, here I am looking at the world through my particular lens, but, you know, this is a two-way conversation. It's also your world, and you can go to whichever links you want, and you can express your perspective, and between us we can conduct a conversation, an open-ended, never-finishing conversation about the world as we see it. And I think that, frankly, can also flush issues out. For example, my blog pioneered and went very hard on the issue of torture early on in the Bush administration, and over the years has compiled a list of resources and links and material and raw material and first-person sources and documents, which you can also link to and people can read, that's the rival of any established newspaper in the world. And I think that's what the web does. We just have this amazing new resource called the World Wide Web. And blogging is one way for journalism to tap into it in a way that's both human and accessible.
You know, it strikes me in reading your piece that some of the things you rave about and are happy and that make you so happy about this new medium are some of the things that first excited me about radio. And that is, you seem to talk about immediacy. That is, you can put an idea out there and you get response immediately, and it edits you, it makes you think, it adjusts what you're writing. Is that true? And can you talk a little bit about that relationship with the people who are reading and responding almost in real time to your blog?
Absolutely. What it is it's somewhere in between a radio show and an op-ed. Mm-hmm. In other words, it's in that little area between writing and speaking. And what it does, it takes the written word and it presents it in real time, almost as fast and as immediate as speaking it. Only, unlike radio, where you do have that real immediacy, in the blog you have a slight delay, so you have the chance to weigh a sentence which will appear at, like, you know, 10 minutes ago, and you'll weigh it for 20 minutes, and before then, and before that time is up, there will be input, criticism, more information. And so it is like performing. It is what I call thinking out loud. Mm. And it's also writing pushed right up to the edge of speaking. And that's why I think actually it's a new form, a new actual idiom, a new way of writing that I think is brand new and only just being really developed.
I want to read just something right off your blog that just caught my eye right now as I was just perusing this. This is one of your readers who says, "Hi, I'm Rob. I've been a longtime reader of The Daily Dish, and your recent piece, Why I Blog, inspired me to finally reach out and send you an email." He goes on, "Your Atlantic essay reminded me that there is still room in the blogosphere for the little guy like me, the full-time student with a lot to say and a priceless outlet to say it. Blogging isn't just about fame and glory, but about interacting with the people who like to hear what you have to say and, of course, those who don't."
I was very excited to get that email because I still think it's absolutely true. This is a democratic medium. And a blog can be successful very small. If it's doing its job right, if it's communicating and interacting with exactly the group of people you want to interact with around the subject matter that you're interested in. And there's the wonderful thing is that there's no barrier to entry. Unlike the old days when, you know, these big publishers, these people that controlled printing presses and paper and distribution networks, were able to make it very hard for a new person to come into the market and offer a new product. Today, there is no barrier to entry. So anybody can start from scratch, that's the whole point of this. You can, I mean, you look at this particular cycle. Let me give you an example of one new blog called 538.com, which has become a sensation, written by someone that used to just do baseball stats, Nate Silver, who's applied all those skills he used to have around baseball to politics and created a one-stop site for anybody to access the latest information in polling. That is an amazing leap forward in people's understanding of what's going on in this election. And he started from scratch. He didn't really exist a year ago, and now he has the traffic of an established media institution. And why? Because he's offering something that people really want to read. So I'm absolutely convinced that if you keep at it, you can establish yourself. But the great thing about this is there is no establishment in the blogosphere.
But isn't that...
You have to earn your readership every day.
But isn't that potentially troubling in this way? And in the context, the overall context of the show is the idea that newspapers are dwindling, a sort of traditional role of reporters going out and working hard and digging and doing the stories and subjecting their work to editors and all that. You're getting work that is reliable, well-informed, and thoughtful. And as that diminishes and more people look to blogs, aren't we going to lose something essential there?
We could if that is what happens. Mm. I'm not sure it is what happens. I'm not sure that we're not just in a transitional phase right now. The old model of financing that kind of reporting, which was by selling these pieces of paper every day, is declining and collapsing. But new ways of financing that reporting will emerge. They'll emerge through advertising online. And essentially, I think that it's simply a way of accessing how you access that reporting.
Hmm.
Do you access it by reading a paper and see on page 4 that such and such a story exists? Or do these institutions pay for this reporting and then bloggers and writers and online merchants all over the world find different angles and links and ways to get at that story?
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking today about newspapers, magazines, and the rise of the citizen journalist online. And we're talking to Andrew Sullivan, who is a senior editor at The Atlantic. He writes the blog The Daily Dish, and his most recent article, Why I Blog, appears in the November issue of The Atlantic. You can link to his blog by going to our website at onpointradio.org. And Andrew Sullivan, before the break, you were in the midst of talking about this new model of financing that is sort of making the blogosphere what it is.
Well, look, in the end, eyeballs will attract advertising. We're just in a period, I think, where we haven't left one model and embraced the other. It's a transitional period. And in that transitional period, I think we're going to have a lot of casualties of the old school. I mean, just saw it this week, Christian Science Monitor going weekly and basically entirely online. But the economics of this are just overwhelming. I mean, I'll give you a very simple example. The Christian Science Monitor now, my own blog now has more page views more than the Christian Science Monitor. The overhead for me is me and one intern. Mm-hmm. That's it. Now, the Christian Science Monitor has a huge staff, buildings, infrastructure, print, paper. There's just no way that given that economic disadvantage that institutional journalism has, that it's going to survive in anything like its current form. So that's the economics of it. However, I also think that those eyeballs and that advertising can finance and should finance not just quick blogging, but real reporting, real analysis, better journalism by getting at both the views of citizens and of ordinary people, but also harnessing the talents of people that haven't been able to get into journalism, who actually have all the skills for it and sometimes more knowledge to create expert niche blogs that tell you everything you want to know about a particular topic from people you learn to trust. And I think that's the thing. You should not trust anything on the internet, but you should learn to trust them. In other words, if they pan out, if day after day you learn to rely on those institutions or those voices, then trust them. In other words, trust but verify. But that's how the New York Times got its reputation in the old days, 100 years ago. That's how everybody used to get their reputation. There's nothing inherently more valuable about news that's printed on dead tree the news that appears on your monitor.
So you're saying the idea that we'll just eventually, I mean, there'll be a lot of stuff out there that probably isn't worth reading because it's written by people who don't really know their facts, who aren't careful, who aren't vetted. And as we go forward, the trustworthy sites will just sort of rise to the top, and those are the ones that we will depend upon.
That's already happened. Mm. I mean, that's already happening. There are plenty of places online which are more reliable than many things you see in print. And their brands will develop and deepen as readers, and it's a very, very open market.
Mm. I mean, but isn't
it's
the
very
fact
flexible.
That it's
the
so
minute you lose yeah. trust, you go.
But isn't the fact that it is so open the thing that makes it just a little bit perilous? And that is, there is no barrier to entry. Anybody can sort of get online and throw up a blog and do it. Whereas in the old days, you know, the dead tree model of journalism, you couldn't. I mean,
yes, and that both. You have to have extra vigilance now mm-hmm. because any random person could be telling you anything. At the same time, the dead tree model protected mediocrity. Hmm. It perpetuated error. It was not as open. It was not as accessible. And it was not as accountable. Hmm. So, you know, it's a mixed bag. I certainly don't want to say that this next phase is somehow utopian. It isn't at all.
Sure.
It's just simply adapting to new technology that's so powerful. And my point about the new technology is that it does two things. It's both on the surface very shallow in the sense that you have lots of different voices and perspectives and biases. But the access to original material, to reports, to data, to real photography, to video, to all the actual raw materials of reporting are actually more plentiful today than they've ever been before. And therefore, blogging and the world of online journalism is going to be deeper than it ever was on Dead Tree.
Hmm. Well, let's bring another voice into the conversation from Newport Beach, California. I'm joined by Nicholas Lemon. He's dean at the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia University. He's written for The Washington Post, The Atlantic, and currently writes for The New Yorker. His 2006 piece about blogging called Amateur Hour, Journalism Without Journalists, appeared in The New Yorker. And Nicholas Lemon, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Good to be here.
It's good to have you. You've been listening to Andrew Sullivan and his view about the brave new world of blogging. Do you agree? Does it herald a golden era of for journalism?
Let's see. We are in the most golden era of a certain kind of journalism that we've ever been in. But journalism is, as they say in the Bible, I'm mangling the Bible a little, a house with many mansions. And the part that is free discourse, free speech, opinion, and kind of developed opinion by analysts who have the ability to perform the analysis on a low-cost basis, as Andrew said, because they do it out of their house or something like that, that's just unbelievably great and you know, far, far preferable to the old model. So I'm not going to make the dumb mainstream media point that it's horrifying that just anybody can get out there and put words out on the blogosphere. Mm-hmm. Essentially, that's always been true. You know, Andrew and I come from the magazine business. If you go to a really big newsstand, you will see that, you know, about two-thirds of magazines you wouldn't bring home to mom in the old media model. Mm. So, you know, we've never wanted or had a real filter on free discussion in this country. And also, the blogosphere is very helpful in breaking down authoritarian structures in other parts of the world. I'm very struck in talking, for instance, to my students from China by their reporting that, you know, the famous Great Firewall of China with 75,000 internet censors has basically broken down completely and just does not work.
Mm. But Nick Lemon, I hear a big reservation coming.
Yes, there. I'm coming to the butt. I'm coming to the butt. And this is the area where I thought Andrew sort of skated over a point. And that is, there are certain forms of journalism which I would generally put under the category of direct on-site reporting that the internet does not support financially, and I worry that it may never support it financially. So that's the big worry here is the blogosphere is wonderful in many, many ways, but as Andrew himself said, it kind of rests on a bedrock of original reporting done currently mostly by mainstream news organizations. They are rapidly losing the economic ability to support their reporting staffs, and that's a problem. In fact, the reason you're talking to me from Newport Beach is I'm right after this show going to a meeting of scientists to kind of brief them on this, because I think it's a real social problem for the country.
What do you think, Andrew Sullivan, this idea that at some basic level a lot of the blogosphere is supported by the work being done by traditional journalists that are fewer and fewer and fewer?
I think Nick is absolutely right. I mean, I think that I am essentially parasitic upon a dying model. And the question is, what happens when that model dies out? And I think what's going to happen, because I don't see why it shouldn't, is that the kind of eyeballs that blogging and the online media are generating, the advertising revenue it will generate, will allow bloggers to also be reporters and also to link to reporters who will do it on their own and develop their own sites and their own voices. In other words, you will just have a disaggregation of the entire process. But the market, in a way, of eyeballs will determine what's reliable and what isn't. Look, I mentioned 538.com. They have, in the last 2 weeks, gone around the country looking at the ground operation in the campaign. And they provided first-hand reporting of what's happening out there. Now, that's amazing. On Election Day, my blog is going to open up to the readers to give first-hand accounts of what it's like to vote on Election Day with photographs and anecdotes and stories that we will bring to the surface. Now, that's real ground-level reporting. And I think that I agree with Nick that currently it's imperiled in the short term, and I worry about that too. But I don't believe it should be imperiled in the long term, because I think people are hungry for information. And I think if real reporters can get out there and provide that information, there is a market for it. It will survive.
Yeah, go ahead, Nick.
I want to make it clear how wrenching and large the transition really is. The kind of thing Andrew was talking about where people contribute to sites is great, and it's one of the wonderful things about the Internet that couldn't happen in the old media. But that doesn't usually produce the kind of information that I'm talking about. Hometown example, the New Orleans Times-Picayune. The stuff Andrew's talking about is really good when a hurricane hits for knowing when the power is going to go on your block. Again, it's like a miracle. It's not really good in knowing why did the city flood in the first place. And there the Times-Picayune reporters did an excellent job, and they're why we know, not through government or anything else. As far as I can tell, the biggest staff of a web-only news organization is Slate, I think. And I'm not counting Bloomberg, which is much, much, much bigger because it's sort of a different category. And Slate has, I think, 32, 35 people, which would be the size of a reporting staff or newsroom staff in a city, 10 years ago, in a city of 100,000 people, a quite small newspaper. So the differences in numbers between what even the most prosperous websites are supporting and what newspapers used to support is just staggeringly large. So again, it's a very wrenching transition. I'd also want to echo one other thing Andrew said, which is, good sites get good traffic. It's quite encouraging and gives you lots of faith in democracy when you look at which journalistic sites are getting the most traffic, because by and large, the sites that establishment types like us would want to have the most traffic, led by the New York Times. People can tell the difference, but the economics of value around that have not really emerged yet, and I'm not sure advertising is going to get us all the way there.
Well, let's bring in some callers. John is calling from Williamsburg, Virginia. Hi, John.
Hi, Anthony. What I wanted to say was my father, who died 2 years ago at age 103, probably every day of his life that I knew him, he came out with a saying that I think is terribly important, which is, your opinion is never any better than your information. And even before blogs were invented, our information has been getting poorer and poorer, probably in favor of entertainment and opinion. And I think this is a very disturbing trend. I don't know if blogs will be able to make up the difference or maybe make it worse. I'll give you an example. I happened to see in Aviation Week a month ago a single paragraph which I think will turn out to be the most important news of the century, but it hasn't appeared in any of the mainstream media. And it said, a company on the West Coast is already in profitable commercial production of artificial petroleum made from seawater, algae, and sunlight. Well, you know, that's entirely scalable, and we'll be able to use it someday to wean ourselves off Middle East petroleum. But nobody has said a word about it.
But, John, your concern is that from the blogosphere does not come usable facts necessarily, or reliable facts.
I don't know.
You're worried about that. Andrew Sullivan, why don't you put John at ease a little bit?
Well, I take his father's grandfather's view very seriously. I think he's absolutely right. However, the good news is we have more access to information. I mean, I say access to information than human beings have ever had in the history of mankind. I mean, our ability to get into databases, to read reports in real time, to examine subjects at great length and great depth has never been greater through the web. The question is whether we want to make use of it and how we present it. Journalists, in a way, we're trying to find a way to bring that information, that's all there, that data, the masses of data, too much data, and find a way to package and present it to readers that saves them time, that filters, that edits, that presents the information as cogently and as... Now look, entertainment can be... Obviously, pure entertainment is not news, but telling a story well, having a good spin on it, having a good sense of language, these things journalists have always understood are critical to getting information into people's brains. So I think, look, I agree with Nick, absolutely. And I think we're going to have a very rough few years. But I don't see in principle why all these new eyeballs in advertising won't actually be able to finance the kind of reporting that Nick and I both agree is absolutely essential to our democracy.
Let me bring in another voice into this conversation. Joining us now from New York is Tina Brown. She was the editor of Vanity Fair from 1984 to 1992 and also the first female editor of The New Yorker. She's the author of a biography of Princess Diana called The Diana Chronicles. And most recently, she co-founded the online site The Daily Beast, where she is also editor. Tina Brown, welcome.
Oh, good to be here.
Well, you've been listening to this conversation. Give us a sense of why you've moved into the blogosphere and you know, what you're able to do there that you weren't able to do before.
Well, so many things. I mean, I moved into the blogosphere because I really strongly felt I wanted to be able to continue as an editor to be part of the conversation of our times, and that I don't feel anymore that print is where that conversation is being had. And to start up a website like this is just, the economic model is so different from the agonies of print and the cost of it and the overhead of it and the whole business of getting this unwieldy product onto the newsstands and promoting it and all of the things that in a way have been sort of part of a print career that I've had and obviously many of us have had for years and years and years. It just is so liberating not to have to do that. And also, actually, I just wanted to be part of the sort of excitement and journalistic sort of experimentation of the web, because it's depressing, frankly, to work in mainstream media at the moment where everybody's kind of wringing their hands and feeling that they're becoming dinosaurs or extinct or made to feel that they're somehow not valued. So it was all of those things really that brought me online, and I'm finding the experience just incredibly liberating and exciting and very, very creative, I must say. I'm enjoying it way more than I ever expected.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about the new face of print media, bloggers, amateur reporters, and the rise of online citizen journalists. And we're joined this hour by Andrew Sullivan. He's a senior editor at The Atlantic, and he writes the blog The Daily Dish. Also joining us is Nicholas Lemon. He's dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia University. And with us is Tina Brown, the former editor of Vanity Fair and The New Yorker, and the co-founder and current editor of the news site, The Daily Beast. And Tina Brown, let me just pick up with you. You were talking before the break about the excitement of this brave new world. I read in USA Today you said you want The Daily Beast to be smart and opinionated. Do you still feel responsible to cover both sides of a story? And are your readers going to get that on a site like The Daily Beast?
Yes. I think that what's great is being able to kind of encourage opinions and posts from all over the spectrum. You know, we had a post yesterday, for instance, from Wendy Button, who was formerly a speechwriter for John Edwards and Obama and the Clinton campaign, who is now saying that she wants to vote for McCain, and that's had a tremendous amount of interest. I think it's terrific to be able to have what is really like a kind of raucous dinner party conversation where there are people arguing and disagreeing with each other. It really is a bore, I think, to always know exactly what opinion you're going to find when you go to a site. So I've really made that very much part of the DNA. But I guess what I love is the spontaneity of the medium, which of course is old hat to pioneers like Andrew Sullivan. But it's just so liberating, and I think I finally found a medium that's commensurate to my impatience, to be actually able to have things that can just come flying in and just go right up. And I don't blog like Andrew does, simply because I don't have the sort of hourly metabolism to do that, I never probably will. But at the same time, I can write for it when I want to, and that is very liberating too. It's just, I think that the way you can develop new voices with such speed that it's fantastic. And I've always loved to do that, to actually go to writers who I know, who I think have got interesting things to say, and ask them to write. I've done that all the way through my editing career, even with print, when, I've met people like Dominic Dunn or Jeffrey Toobin, who were actually not, writing for magazines before I brought them into the mix. But to be able to just sort of turn around and create sort of new voices online, and you see them get amazing followings really quickly, it's just inspiring. It's an extraordinarily creative medium. I think Andrew's right when he said in that brilliant piece in The Atlantic that we're in a golden age of journalism.
Mm. Nicholas Lemon, I want to bring you back into this conversation with the voice of caution. I mean, the title and
have to be?
Well,
okay, no, I'll be okay. I won't be the voice of caution.
You don't mind. I mean, the title and the subtitle of the New Yorker piece that you wrote a couple of years ago says a lot. The Wayward Press, Amateur Hour, Journalism Without Journalists. I mean, is that what we're at risk of going toward here? Journalism without journalists?
Let's divide journalists into two categories. I'm going to be repeating myself a little, but it's important to be clear. One is the idea, as the bloggers say, the so-called gatekeeper function of journalists. That is, the journalist is the person who sort of gets to decide what is in the public discourse and what's news and what it consists of. I'm not going to defend that. There are colleagues of mine who will, but I think that's an actively bad idea, and in that way the new world is better. The other is journalists as, if you'll forgive me for using a $10 word, epistemologists. That is, people who actually go out and discover, go on site and find out the truth of a situation. The reason we know there was an Abu Ghraib, and the reason that we know that the war in Iraq didn't go very well for a long time, and the reason we know about secret prisons, and the reason we know about renditions, the reason we know about Walter Reed Hospital, that stuff doesn't come from the blogosphere. It comes from people who actually are paid to go out and gather, assess, and present information. So my big worry here is with in our excitement about the blogosphere, that many of us tend to forget that it rests on this base of information that is derived by working journalists, reporters. Sort of the Main Street to Wall Street comparison might be apt. And if those people go away, which is happening before our eyes very rapidly, the society will have lost something precious. It will not be replaced by, to use the jargon, the crowd.
Mm. Tina Brown,
so
can the blog...
Caution.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, go ahead, Tina Brown. I want to ask you about that concern.
I entirely agree with that. I simply don't think that one has to replace the other. I mean, I think that the online instant material is really has to be a new medium that is like sort of radio to television or whatever. You know, I don't think that in any way the one replaces the other.
Right. It's a medium of comment, though, essentially.
Yeah. It's a medium of comment, and I think the most important thing really is for particularly mainstream media organizations who are doing things online, they need to really continue their role of spending the kind of money that they did on print journalism online. And what I really hate is when the custodians of that kind of journalism start thinking that the way to sort of solve their cost issues is to basically throw out all the real reporters and sort of we'll get a bunch of kids and we'll do stuff online and we'll kind of have a new business model and we'll make money eventually with that. I think that is suicide from their point of view, by the way, because the fact is that people will not want to do without information and reporting. Reporting is really coinage of incredible value, and somehow it will evolve to find its way online and be financed. I mean, whether it's by advertising, or whether it's by philanthropies, or whether it's by collectives, or whatever, however it happens, and there may need to be a new kind of financial structure, you know, to finance it with. But we cannot do without that kind of serious, big time reporting. We absolutely shouldn't. And I myself think that we have to keep after the organizations that do have the sort of the resources and do have those new structures to not think that they're now off the hook and should stop doing it.
Tina Brown, I know we have to let you go, but I want to thank you for joining us today. I appreciate it very much.
All right. Thank you.
That's Tina Brown. She's founder and editor-in-chief of the online news site The Daily Beast, which just launched this month. Andrew Sullivan, I know you wanted to chime in on that conversation.
Well, I just think I'd like to add what the medium also brings to the table in terms of real reporting. For example, and I'll take the example that Nick gave of Abu Ghraib and the issue of torture. Absolutely right. Without the reporting of Jane Mayer or Dana Priest and a variety of people who have really done the work, we would not have gotten this story. However, the ability for a blogger such as myself to pioneer the story, to push it to the front, and also to access information that's already available, the reports on torture that have been issued within the military, and present them to readers so they can read for themselves, the log of Detainee 063, which you can put online and tell your readers is important and they can read it. The fact that soldiers in the field were able to email me and say, I saw this abuse happening, and I can put that up there. In other words, reporting also comes from the bottom up. The torture story was pioneered mainly from people within the existing military CIA and administration who leaked and talked to reporters, but also to bloggers. In other words, it's not either or, as Tina was saying. You can, with a blog, both amplify and create a new audience for real investigative reporting. I mean, there is a tendency in some of these newspapers to do investigative reporting that no one reads, that sits there as a special report of 5 pages. And yes, it's very important and it should be done, but no one's reading it. Mm. And what we can do as bloggers is both get people interested in this information, but also get the primary sources to people's minds so they can read it themselves. Mm. I mean, the Palin story with the Anchorage Daily News, for example, has done a fantastic job on the story of Sarah Palin. But were it not for the blogosphere, no one would have been reading the Anchorage Daily News. You can't get a hold of it. But it's become – its traffic is up 900% over last year because the blogosphere allowed readers to access the Anchorage Daily News and its local reporting and its archives to go back and find out about this unknown person that became the vice presidential nominee with really good reporting. And that's what you don't get in the old model. You also get the ability to go back in time.
So it's sort of a news aggregator, you're saying. I mean, it's sort of aggregator.
News aggregator, but also you can direct people into the past. Mm-hmm. You can bring stuff that's at the bottom to the surface. And you can let the readers access the information in ways that is much more interesting and engaging than a 5-page special report that no one gets past the second paragraph on when it's actually put in the paper.
Let's get some calls in. We've got a bunch of people standing by. Kevin is calling from Washington, D.C. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, Anthony. I'm a fan of Andrew's blog, but I think he underestimates the danger of losing print and broadcast journalism outlets. It's naive to suggest that online advertising is going to pay for professional journalism. I began working for a major Metro Daily Papers website in 1996. That was 12 years ago, and we said then that online ads would replace print advertising, and it still hasn't happened. Online readers also have demonstrated that they won't pay for content. So it's the $100,000 question that I think we need to keep asking. how do you fund journalism in the future, and what is the impact on our democracy as newspapers cut back and shut down?
Hmm. I think those are great questions. Nick Lemon, I mean, Kevin brings up a great question that obviously print newsrooms have been dealing with for years and years. I know NPR is dealing with it. The younger generation isn't tuning into our broadcast the way 40-something, 50-something people are. We're all trying to figure out what is the new funding model for journalism.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very, very involved in that whole conversation right now. I share Kevin's skepticism about Andrew's optimism about advertising eventually growing to the role of a full replacement revenue model.
But what's our alternative? What's our alternative? I mean,
well, I'm going to tell you the alternative right now. First of all, I think we need to reopen the paid content conversation. And the way that will work generally is things that look like Bloomberg, where a news organization is providing very, very highly specialized, actionable information and that people are willing to pay for. Consumer Reports would be a consumer report-oriented example. And then on top of that gets layered other stuff. The other thing is, I think, you know, and this is very hard to get my colleagues to talk about, but, you know, since I'm on NPR, maybe it'll be a little easier. We need to have a policy conversation as well as a business model conversation. We need to think about whether we're in a moment like the moment when public broadcasting was created in the United States 40 years ago, when, you know, some mix of public, private, regulatory tax structures needs to be devised that will support this hollowed out reporting structure. I think that doesn't mean that we don't, I mean, we live in a market economy. One of the wonderful things about it is people will look for the business model like mad, praying they find it. But, you know, I'm not saying we shouldn't do that, but I'm saying in addition, we should be talking about what I'm calling a policy model.
Mm. Well, all good ideas and provocative and probably grist for another 10 shows on this subject. Let's try to get another call in. Randy is calling from Salt Lake City, Utah. Hi, Randy.
Hi there. Yes, I was calling because my big concern is credibility and accountability with blogging. I guess last caller said of actionable information. I mean, so often it kind of degenerates into like a level of opinion and talk show radio as opposed to, you know, something real. And if something goes wrong, who do you actually go to and, you know, can you sue anybody? I mean, I think paid content is probably going to come up as some alternative to just listening to, you know, 1,000 different opinions.
Well, let's put that question to Andrew Sullivan. Andrew, is there a burden of proof on bloggers to fact-check stories?
Yes, of course. I mean, not every story we might link to. Hmm. Anything that we publish, it seems to me, we should be aware of whether it's true or not. And if, you know, sometimes putting something out there, for example, a yell in a crowd at a Palin rally, and it's not quite sure what was said. Was it a slur? Was it not a slur? Well, now we have YouTube. We can put it up there, and as long as a blogger, I think, says, "Look, I don't know actually right now. Here it is. You make your mind up." And within a few minutes, the collective brain of the blogosphere will have figured it out. I mean, that's what happens. And as a blogger, you have to correct yourself. If you don't correct yourself when you make mistakes, and we all make mistakes, you will lose credibility and you lose readership. But I tell you, actually writing a blog and having to go out there and say, "Correction, I screwed up," as opposed to having it buried in spinach on page 2 days later, which no one reads, I think the incentives to be correct and factual are actually higher individually on the web than they are on Dead Tree.
Hmm. What do you think, Nicholas Lemon? Is that
I'm you know, basically persuaded by that. The some of the mainstream media, like The New Yorker, has a quite good before-the-fact checking apparatus, but a lot doesn't. I mean, I just, you know, flew out here to California and watched cable news for 6 hours, and, you know, the amount of misinformation that you get in 6 hours of switching among all those networks is stunning, and as Andrew said, there's no way to correct it. The blogosphere is quite good at post-facto fact-checking, or post-publication fact-checking. It works more, oddly enough, the way the academic world works, with a lot faster time pace.
It's sort of a peer review process.
Yeah, it's a peer review. It's an informal peer review process. So the only thing, you know, is some news organizations, although I wouldn't say most, have much more elaborate before publication checking, and that would be ideal, but it's extremely expensive.
Let me ask one last question. We're almost out of time. This question actually came in to our website during the show. As for blogging, is there a, quote, blogging rating agency? How do I find high-quality bloggers like Andrew Sullivan, who write about subjects from green energy to the financial crisis, et cetera? Any ideas, Andrew, about sort of helping the news consumer kind of cull through the huge and growing multitude of sources out there?
To be perfectly frank, I would suggest to that reader, do it yourself. Caveat reader. The new media requires the reader and the consumer of news to be much more engaged. No more sitting back passively accepting everything that Walter Cronkite tells you, or Dan Rather tells you, or whoever tells you. You have to have a different attitude towards the news. You have to be engaged, skeptical, and follow your nose. And the people you learn to trust yourself, follow them. And you'd be amazed. Because it's so open and because the corrective mechanisms are so clear, it won't take you long. But I don't want to tell anybody. I don't think there's anybody that should say this is more reliable than that. I think the audience and the readers should figure it out.
Andrew Sullivan, we're going to have to leave the program there with that challenge on the table. Thank you for joining us today.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
That's Andrew Sullivan. He writes the blog The Daily Dish and is senior editor at The Atlantic. And Nicholas Lemon, dean at the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism, thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
It was great having you. You can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.